Exposing corporate frauds and market shifts.
I'm like, I said to him, I said, we'll just call him Bob. I'm like, Bob, this is a fucking fraud. This is WeWork with a climate change veneer smeared over it. I thought that was going to get more attention than the WeWork post because I thought it was even more obvious of fraud.
Few people actually knew what Aspiration was, which I think is why it was so prescient of you to point it out. I just want to point out what some of the red flags we found with this company were. So the first red flag was that they were trying to SPAC, and there were just a bunch of kind of bullshit companies that were SPACing. They did have a giant celebrity investor list. One of those investors was Leo DiCaprio. That was kind of a red flag. And then as we looked into it, it started to get worse and worse. So they had this ESG fund that they called the Redwood Fund, and they charged these exorbitant fees on it. But when we looked at the actual portfolio, what we found is that it was just a regular portfolio. And they even had positions in Southwest Airlines, which, of course, burns through fuel, and also a fracking company, which was hilarious. Their worst crime, though, was this thing called EBITDAM.
God, like community-based EBITDA, WeWork.
Exactly. This was earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, and marketing. And according to this company, they were EBITDAM profitable. But then you look at the fine print and you realize they were spending 150% of their revenue on marketing. So they're trying to position themselves as a profitable company, but they're saying, oh, this marketing thing, we're spending basically all of our money on marketing, but don't worry about that. We're profitable. And that was sort of our biggest red flag. This company is bullshitting their investors. And so it never SPAC'd, and now the guy's going to jail.
I loved Adam Neumann's initial redefinition of EBITDA, and it was like earnings before everything else, earnings before Dolly Parton. Earnings before March Madness. It was just, yeah. It was like, let's pretend that profits are top line revenues before expenses. Let's just get rid of this pesky thing called expenses so we can say, pretend that we're profitable. But yeah, I appreciate the recognition and drinks on me this week in Austin.
Can't wait. Let's get into our weekly review of Market Vitals. The S&P 500 declined, the dollar slid, Bitcoin was volatile, and the yield on 10-year treasuries climbed. Shifting to the headlines. Disney is laying off nearly 200 employees, or 6%, of its workforce in its ABC News Group and Disney Entertainment Networks divisions. As part of the cuts, the company is also shutting down political and data journalism site 538, which it acquired in 2013. Walgreens is officially going private after closing a $10 billion deal with Sycamore Partners. The private equity firm is expected to keep Walgreens' core U.S. retail business while potentially selling off or spinning out other parts of the company. And finally, Ontario cancelled a Starlink contract worth $100 million Canadian dollars after U.S. tariffs on Canadian imports took effect. Scott, let's get your thoughts, starting with Disney deciding to lay off 200 employees, nearly 6% of the workforce at ABC and their entertainment networks.
It just makes sense. This is part of capitalism, and that is they need to consolidate, bulk up, and then cut costs. These companies should have one back end as far as news, and if they have different front-facing brands that appeal to different audiences, that's fine. But last year, Disney's linear networks revenue declined 9%, and operating income was down 16%. They're not alone here. U.S. linear TV advertising will decrease an estimated 4% annually through 2030, which doesn't seem like a lot. But when it's going for another 5 years, 4%, it means it's going to lose a quarter of its revenue or a fifth. And that means, you know, that's just real pain because some of those costs are fixed. So you're talking they're probably going to shed another 20 or 30% of their workforce over the next 5 years. I just had lunch with a fairly famous news anchor who is fantastic at what she does, and she's one of the lucky ones. She's still making a lot of money, but I think her salary got cut by 30%, and you're seeing cuts across the most famous anchors of like 20 to 80%.
Leadership and revolt. The impact of economic boycotts on Musk's ventures.
It's done. It's gone. We won't award contracts to people who enable and encourage economic attacks on our province and our country.
Kind of baller. Your reaction, Scott?
I think Musk, when he saw this, I think this probably sent a chill down his spine. If people start canceling Starlink contracts, I mean, they're already throwing shit at Tesla's on the road. I just canceled a Tesla last night on Uber. I'm starting to cancel if it's a Tesla when it comes up. I think that Canada, I think this guy's making the right move, and I think you're only going to see more of it. I think people have just had it. What's a shame is that we don't have the same type of leadership here in the United States. There hasn't been a single CEO who stood up and said, I am not going to participate in this pay-for-play kleptocracy. I'm not giving to the campaign. I am not going to be paraded around. You either have laws that affect all of us or none of us, but I have had it. And we haven't had anyone that shows the balls of this leader up in Ontario. And it is so disappointing, the domino theory of cowardice that has infected the rich and Fortune 500 CEOs. I can't think of one who has spoken out, all under the auspices of quote-unquote shareholder value. Well, folks, your stakeholders include Americans. It is incredibly disappointing that we aren't showing a fraction of leadership that this guy is showing.
But I think you say, I mean, the domino theory of cowardice, I think this is basically showing that we're about to see the domino theory of revolt. I mean, this guy's the first one to do it, and it's only $100 million, which is not a big deal for Starlink, which did $8 billion in revenue last year. But Canada overall is Starlink's second largest market behind the US. They've got 500,000 Starlink subscribers in Canada. And I think what this shows is, you know, this guy's the first to do it, but we're going to see a domino effect. And I think all of these other provinces follow suit. I don't think you want to be a leader in Canada who looks weak up against Donald Trump. And what we're seeing is that the entire nation is sort of coming together and rallying against a common enemy. And there's just this one stat I found fascinating from YouGov. 82% of Americans say they consider Canada to be an ally. In Canada, that number is now 33%.
I think this is what is going to probably push Musk out of government, or he is going to decide he's going to try and declare victory and leave. Because if you look at Starlink customer base, I mean, Tesla is already crashing. It's literally imploding. I don't know if you saw a video of Mardi Gras and someone, a Tesla truck or whatever you call it, was rolling down and everyone started just throwing shit at it. Starlink was his growth vehicle. And there's 1.5 million customers of Starlink in the U.S. You referenced that there's 530,000 in Canada, its second largest market. That's real. And then the number three market, Mexico, at 435,000. And then the number four is Brazil, who probably doesn't feel that great about Musk, who was threatening, you know, was fucking with their internal politics. So, you know, Starlink's value in the private markets, it's the most valuable company, one of the most valuable private companies and the most traded in the secondary market. And I think it's a third of $1 trillion. I think it's trading at $3 or $350 billion. That number is going to come way down, because if they can't show the kind of growth that they've been showing, also you are seeing a lot of, you want to talk about greed glands going. If I'm Telesat or Explore, the competitors, they have no trouble raising a shit ton of money right now. And because there is about to be a big gap in the marketplace for this type of broadband provider.
That's what happened with Twitter. And then you saw all those Twitter competitors rise up, and now Threads,
Blue Sky, Post. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, some of them kind of failed.
Yeah, the one I invested in. But is that what you're saying, Ed? Is that what you're saying, the one I invested in? The one I managed to pick?
That was what I was hinting at.
Okay.
Strategic moves. BlackRock's bold investment in the Panama Canal.
Having said that, I think what the guy at CK Hutchison is trying to get at is that from a commercial perspective, this was an amazing deal for them. The origins of the deal were political, but the result was a success, because the value of those ports that they sold, as determined by analysts, was $13 billion. They sold it for $23 billion. So they got a nearly 80% premium on those assets. That is huge. And by the way, $23 billion is more than the entire market cap of the company before the deal. And as a result, shares in the company skyrocketed. They were up 20%. So it's a huge success for this company, CK Hutchison. And I think that begs the question, okay, they sold it for 80% above market value. Why was BlackRock down to pay? Why were they down to splurge that much in what is now the largest infrastructure deal in the company's history? How did that make sense to them? And I have some initial thoughts, but I'll throw it back to you. What do you think was the draw for BlackRock here?
I would have just thought that they believe that their average price per vessel of $341,000 that's charged to get through the Panama Canal, that they believe they can take that 341 number much higher.
No, I think what's in it for BlackRock and what made this worth it is what it does to their relationship with the president, because he looks excellent now. You know, he was talking about how he wants the U.S. to control the Panama Canal, and people were ragging on him saying this guy doesn't know what he's doing, and he pulled it off and at no cost to the government. The whole thing was paid for by BlackRock. And there is no denying this only happened because of him. So he looks like a genius now. He gets to brag about it in his speeches. In fact, that's exactly what he did in his address to Congress. And most importantly, I think he is now grateful to Larry Fink and to BlackRock, who are officially in his good books now. And that's so important because for a long time they weren't. This is the company that spearheaded the ESG movement, that told investors that DEI is central to everything they do. This is the company that, just generally speaking, the Republicans hated. And so I think Larry Fink saw this opportunity. There was a chance to get on Trump's good side, to make him look like the hero. And it only cost him, you know, a few billion dollars. So in my view, it was probably worth it.
I didn't immediately connect that this gets them in Trump's good graces, but I can see the argument. If so, I can't imagine they would make this sort of capital outlay. I think that would be being a bad fiduciary just to cozy up to a guy who's going to be in office another 3 years and 9 months, and quite frankly, in about 2 years.
Don't you think that is an economic decision at this point? I feel like what we're seeing with these companies is actually it is your fiduciary obligation to suck up to the president.
I think your analysis is more thoughtful than mine. I just assume that if they could put a toll booth on both sides of the Panama Canal, that if you do the math, I would bet it costs a lot more than an incremental $340,000 to take that ship around, to go the long way. And they sense that and say, all right, we're capturing 10% of the savings here. We should be capturing 30 or 40%.
Fair enough. I think in the context of what they've been doing recently, I mean, just a couple of months ago, we didn't discuss this on the podcast, but they withdrew from this climate initiative with the United Nations. They also, they just released their annual report. They cut all references of DEI in their report. They backpedaled from ESG a ton. And this is just a huge turnaround from 2021, when they were kind of leading this charge. Like, they were at the forefront of DEI and ESG. I'll quote Larry Fink in their 2021 annual report. He said, quote, "We must embed DEI into everything we do." And then poof, suddenly the DEI is gone. Suddenly the ESG is gone. And he's making phone calls to the Trump saying, hey, that thing you were talking about, this Panama thing, we're really interested and we think we can represent the U.S.
I've switched. I'm now, when I'm interviewing people, I'm saying, oh, he's a DUI hire.
I think you're a DUI hire.
Yeah, I've never had a DUI.
I'm surprised.
Market predictions and tech insights.
It should, but I think that's going to change. I think PE is getting their green glands going. And I think they're finally going to start acting like a union and take advantage of their size. So I'm very excited about Europe, and I'm very, you know, the bottom line is American tech is still going to do really well. It's just too fucking expensive.
Let's take a look at the week ahead. We'll see the consumer and producer price indices for February, and we'll also see earnings from Oracle, Adobe, and Williams-Sonoma. Scott, do you have any predictions?
I want you to make a prediction, Ed, and I think you just made one.
My prediction would be that Apple is sub $200 in the next 6 months. I think that their numbers are flatlining, their hardware revenue is down, and they've been leaning on a narrative. And I think that narrative is fizzling out because you can just look at their products and you can look at their ads. It's becoming very clear this is a very mature and increasingly uninteresting company. I'm not sure how I feel about you selling all of your Apple. I'm also not sure how I feel about you going totally out of U.S. growth entirely. I think there's still a lot of value in U.S. tech, in companies like, you know, NVIDIA and Google, for example, I'm pretty bullish on. But Apple, I think that's probably a good idea to trim.
So I'm excited to see you in Texas. The last time I was in Texas, I was in Lubbock, and I came across a sheep farm, and there was a farmer fucking a sheep on the side of the road. And I said, in New York, we shear sheep. And he said, I'm not shearing her with anyone. I'll see you in Austin. I'll see you in the great state of Texas.
Thank you for listening to Prof G Markets from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Join us on Thursday for our South by Southwest episode, only on Prof G Markets.